We can get going. So where we just ended is we were talked about this long Mishnah about the various people who brought the wood for the temple. There were specific families supposed to take it. Two things I wanted to add about that, which is number one, most of these families are mentioned in Ezra or Nehemiah. So there seem to be like families that came to Israel from the exile in Babel. The other thing is that it says at the end, Echad Betevet, they wouldn't have any ma'amad at all because there's halal, korban musaf, and korban itzim. But if you pay attention, there's actually another date where this would be true, which is the first of Nisan, which is also which is Rosh Chodesh, and therefore has musaf, halal, and bringing the wood. So there you go. What are you going to do about that? But it turns out there are actually 2 days a year where they wouldn't have the ma'amad, but for some reason the Mishnah only mentions one. Presumably because the Tevet is the one that's likely to happen. Actually, no, I don't know why. I don't know what, presumably why. There's no presumably. So there you go. Just a thing to notice. And it gets resolved in the Gemara, whatever. Okay, so now we're sort of leaving that whole discussion of the Korban Eitzim. We've left the discussion of the flexible fast in response to disasters. And now we're talking about the specific fasts, which will be Shiva Asar Batamuz and Tisha B'Av. There are four fasts which are mentioned in Zechariah, which basically correspond to the fast of Tevet, the fast of Tammuz, fast of Av, and the fast of Tishrei, of Tzom Gedalia. Those are mentioned in Zechariah. They're pretty old. They're like way in straight after the exile. He doesn't explain, he doesn't tell you, A, which specific days they're on. He just tells you which months they're in. And number two, he doesn't tell you what they're for, why you're commemorating those fast days. And the context in which he talks about them is to say that these fast days will one day be turned into days of rejoicing. And that theme is going to sort of come up a little bit here. So, but first we're going to start talking about what actually happened on these two summer fast days, the 17th of Tammuz and the 9th of Av. Chamisha dvarim eru et avotenu b'shiva asar b'tammuz v'chamisha b'tisha b'av. There were five things that happened to our ancestors on the 17th of Tammuz, and the five things that happened on Tisha B'Av. B'shivar Sarba Tammuz, here are the five things. Nishtaberu haluchot, the tablets were broken. This is when Moshe came down the mountain and saw the golden calf and smashed the tablets. So that happened on the 17th of Tammuz, according to this tradition. Uvatal hatamid, the regular offerings of the temple ceased. Probably this is the second temple during the siege of Jerusalem, but it's not totally clear. A lot of these you'll see, it's unclear whether they're talking about the first temple or the second temple. They sort of blend together, the two temples in this tradition. Yeah, so Batal HaTamid, the Tamid stopped on the 17th of Tammuz during presumably the siege of Jerusalem, I think the second time. Uvka'ah Ha'ir, the city was breached, the town was breached, which is, again, not totally clear, but I think the date of the walls being breached is known for the first temple, and it's not the 17th of Tammuz. So I think this has to be the second temple. V'saraf apostmos et haTorah. I can't tell you anything about this event. Don't know who apostmos is. Don't know anything about when apostmos burnt a Torah. But we're remembering when somebody burnt a Torah for some reason. Apostmos is a Greek name, but that's all I can tell you. It's not at all clear what we're referring to here. And they set up an image in the sanctuary, in the temple. I think the Talmud Bavli understands that this is also referring to Apostemos, whoever that is, that Apostemos is the one who set up the image in the Heichal, in the sanctuary. But in the Yerushalmi, it's understood to be talking about the first temple period, and therefore can't be the second temple period, Apostemos. It's talking about when the King Menashe set up an idol in the temple. Who's one of the first temple kings. Going on a limb here, but could apostmos be just any apostate? Yeah, I don't know if they have the word apostate in Greek for them, because they would normally call that person like a mumar or something. Tisha B'Av, so that was all the 17th of Tammuz, those five things that we're commemorating, the breaking of the luchot, the ending of the regular sacrifice, the breaching of the walls of the city of Jerusalem, and something about apostmos, whoever that is, and the image of Menashe, perhaps, or the image that apostolos put in the temple. B'tisha B'Av, nigzar al avotenu shelo yikanesu la'aretz. Now we're going to get to Tisha B'Av, and the first event is that our ancestors were decreed that they were not allowed to go into the land. This is the generation of the wilderness. that they were on Tisha B'Av, it was told to them that they were not allowed to enter the land of Israel because of the spies. V'charav habayit barishana uvashniya, and it was the destruction of the first and second temple. Both happened on Av, 9th of Av. V'nilkada beitar, beitar was captured. Beitar is the last battle in the Bar Kokhba revolt. It's the last town that the Judeans controlled that was lost to the Romans. That also happened on Tisha B'Av, about 60 years after the destruction of the temple. The Nechrasha Ha'ir, and the city was plowed. Jerusalem was plowed. After the Bar Kokhba revolt, the Jerusalem was dismantled to a certain extent, and no Jews were allowed there for a long time. And that's, I think, what we're talking about here. And it became a new city called Aeola Capitolina or something like that. Some Latin word I don't remember. And Jews were not allowed there for a long time. Great, so this is just the various disasters that happened on this day. What I find interesting about this list is the way that it sort of blends together biblical examples, like from the Torah's period, and biblical examples from the First Temple period, from the period of the kings, and also like more contemporary events, only 200 to 300 years in the past of the Mishnah. So that's a really interesting blending of the various things. Also, why do all these things happen in the summer? I don't know if this is true, but this is what I was told one time, is that wars were fought in the Middle East during the summer because it would be often too muddy during the rainy season of the winter. So therefore, it's not actually totally nuts that the temple would be destroyed on roughly the same day. Though I think if you did the evidence of the first temple period, I think you might find some contradictory evidence of when exactly it was destroyed. But regardless, the point is the summer makes sense as a time to commemorate these things, as a time when war could have happened. But I don't know if that's true at all. It's just what I heard. Now we're going to start talking about Tisha B'Av. And we get literally one Mishnah about Tisha B'Av in the Masechet of Ta'anit. Misha nichnas Av, mema'atin besimcha. Sorry. When Av enters, once Av starts, you reduce in happiness. The opposite of Adar, where we marbin besimcha for Purim, we increase happiness. And now the next Mishnah is going to explain some of the things that entails. Shabbat shechal tishba av lichyot betocha. So here Shabbat means week and not the day of Shabbat, because of the words betocha in its midst, i.e. during the 7 days of that week. So if the week that falls, the tishba av falls in, asur milasaper ulmichabes, it's forbidden to get your hair cut and to do laundry. You're supposed to look disheveled. Uvachamishi mutarin mipnei chavod haShabbat. But on the Thursday, you're allowed to do those things in order for the honor of Shabbat. So it sounds like this particular case is that Tisha B'Av is on Friday, and therefore your only day to like make yourself presentable for Shabbat is the Thursday, because you can't do these things on Tisha B'Av itself. So therefore, you're allowed to do it on Thursday in order that you look presentable for Shabbat on Saturday, because you can't do it on Friday. Nowadays, it's not possible for Tisha B'Av to fall on a Friday. Never happens, but for them it was, because the months were more flexible. Oh, and also this now, there's what we think of as the prohibitions of Tisha B'Av. There's two periods. There's the 3 weeks between Shivat Arba Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, and then there's the 9 days from Av starting and ending. That's a little bit different from saying there's the week of Tisha B'Av, that week alone, which is just like from the Sunday until whenever day of the week Tisha B'Av falls, whether it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Sunday, versus what we're going to have here, which is also Erev Tisha B'Av, just like the day before is a prohibition. Whereas now these prohibitions will apply for longer. So like most people, the prohibition of cutting your hair or doing laundry applies to all 9 days of Av today. So the Mishnah has a slightly different perspective on what those two periods should be than we do. We have 9 days and 3 weeks. They had basically the week of Tisha B'Av and the day before. It was much more localized. But we do have this previous Mishnah, which says once Av enters, you reduce in happiness. Yeah, and it was also, this might include things that are not mentioned in this Mishnah. It might be broader than, for example, cutting your hair and laundry. It might include things like marriages or various other things, like you shouldn't have parties. So there's clearly a 9 days somewhere here. But there's these prohibitions sort of blend together into the pre-existing structure of 3 weeks and 9 days. Erev Tisha B'Av, lo yochal adam shnei tavshilin, lo yochal basar, v'lo yishtei yayin. The day before Tisha B'Av, shouldn't eat two cooked dishes. That's a large meal, one assumes, like some kind of substantial meal. lo yochol basar, and you shouldn't eat meat, that gives you too much joy, velo yishteh yayin, and don't drink wine. And again, like the meat, for example, the meat prohibition goes for us all the way to the beginning of Av, but for them it was just the day before. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel has a lower level of what you have to do the day before. The only thing you have to do is yishaneh, you have to change your practice. So if you had, for example, if you would normally have three cooked dishes during a day, you should have two instead. You normally eat a lot of meat, maybe you should eat a little bit less meat, or you normally have two cups of wine, just have one cup of wine. But you don't have to cut it out in total, you just have to reduce your pleasure. And the halakha does not follow him at all, definitely follows the first opinion. So this is just all about, like, you know, the run-up. They have this whole sense of the run-up to Tish B'Av should be in some kind of mourning, and this is the next, Rabbi Huda is now going to be the next, the most clear expression of this. Rabbi Huda mechayev b'chviyat hamita. Rabbi Huda makes you liable, requires you on Tish B'Av to, or Erev Tish B'Av it could be, to overturn the bed. Overturning the bed is a mourning custom in the Mishnah and in Eretz Israel in general in these days. It's basically like sitting on the floor, which is actually what we do on Tish B'Av. So yeah, you're supposed to overturn the bed, you're supposed to sit on the floor as if you're in mourning. But lo hodu lo chachamim, and the sages didn't agree with him. Except for the fact that actually it turned out that this Rabbi Huda has the halakha. This is exactly what we do, and that's why in the evening and morning of Tish B'Av you sit on the floor and not on chairs, because of Rabbi Huda here. So basically just trying to set up a sort of faux mourning practice. That is essentially all the information we get from the Mishnah about Tish B'Av. That was it. Now, we mentioned, this might be considered blasphemous, but I don't regret the loss of the temple. I much prefer rabbinic Judaism, and the irony of reading about mourning the temple in the text of rabbinic creation is not lost in me. Yes, I also don't regret the loss of the temple, I have to tell you. So not greeting people in Tish B'Av. The custom not greeting Tish B'Av. Once you have this Rabbi Huda of, I don't know the exact arc, but I can pretty see that once you have this Rabbi Huda, that you're liable in some mourning rituals, and there are some other mourning rituals here about not having laundry done, then you're going to start to accrue other mourning rituals, like not greeting, etc. There are five things here. There's not, the loss of the temple is only one of them, right? There's also Nilkada Beitar, Jerusalem was plowed over, they were not allowed into the land. There are three other things here, not just about the temple. And same thing with Shiva Sarva Tammuz, so there's lots of other things to mourn. And the other thing is about the text of rabbinic creation. Yes, text of rabbinic creation, except that we don't know how much of it was actually intact during the temple time, and therefore it might, it's not exactly a like reconstruction, it might be just a faithful reproduction of temple practice. It's hard to know those things. I think like the statements of like rabbinic creativity and creation of something totally new of a new Judaism are normally overstated. I think there's generally more continuity between pre-temple and post-temple than people give it credit for. I think the loss is more relatable when you consider there was mass deportation that continued for a century or so afterwards, a substantial loss of life. Yes, so that's true. One of the interesting things about the Bar Kokhba revolt versus the destruction of the temple is that, you know, we think of today as the destruction of the temple as this sort of watershed event, which like ended a whole period of Jewish history. But actually, if you look at the archaeology, there are Jews living in Judea before 70, and there are basically the same number of Jews living in Judea after 70. So yeah, there were fewer Jews in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was destroyed, but like it didn't affect the life of Jews that much in any other place. Once you hit 132 or 135, the Bar Kokhba revolt, before the Bar Kokhba revolt, there are Jews living in Judea, totally normal settlements. After the Bar Kokhba revolt, there are no Jews in Judea anymore. The Jews are only in Galilee. So it's like kind of, if you actually, the archaeology suggests that the destruction of the temple was not the watershed event, it was Bar Kokhba that was the watershed event. Like that was really the end of Jewish settlement in Judea. And therefore, in some ways, this Nilkada Beitar is actually like much more raw and had much more loss of life and change of practice and life for the Jews of the period. Like it's hard to imagine, but like the way the Bar Kokhba revolt basically played out is that the Romans went from village to village, basically wiping out every town of Jews because there was a guerrilla warfare. They couldn't fight in a field of battle because if they did, the Romans were certainly going to win. So yeah. Yes, good. If you want to read more about the mourning rituals that the Mishnah has, which then gets transferred to Tisha B'Av, yeah, you can go to Moed Katan, which is elsewhere in Moed. which is fun. So anyway, that was that lovely and cheery discussion. But as often happens, Masechet ends with words of comfort. And that's what we're going to get here. We mentioned above the 15th of Av as one of the days where they would bring the Korban Eitzim, the offering of the wood for the temple. And here it is. Here, we're going to mention it again. And also Yom Kippur, which, by the way, also didn't mention Yom Kippur in the entire thing about fasting, but we had a whole Masechet Yoma that you could learn about it as well. Okay, so this is a Mishnah with a bunch of different variations that I'm going to take you through. And also it's like actually one of the most complex Mishnayot. You could see it has a lot of different component parts that seem to contradict each other. So let's play that out a little bit. But it is like a really wonderful Mishnah. Amar Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, Lo hayu yamim tovim li Yisrael kachamisha asar ba'av yom makipurim. These were the happiest days of the year. There were no happier days for Israel than the 15th of Av and Yom Kippur. Shebahen benot Yerushalayim yotzot bichli lavan shu'ulin. For on that day, the daughters of Jerusalem would go out with white clothes that were borrowed, in order they wouldn't embarrass anyone who didn't have them. So they all sort of shared their white garments and they went out into the fields. Kol hakelim t'unin t'vila. And this is a random aside, which is just to say, and also all of the clothes that they wore would have been dunk. They would have been washed before the day. They would have required washing. So emphasizing like the purity of these days, the cleanness. Uvenot Yerushalayim yotzot v'cholot bakramim. And the daughters of Jerusalem would go out and dance in the vineyards. One of the things that's not totally clear, by the way, is when Rabbi Shimon Gamliel stops talking. So you should think about when this happens, when you think he stops. We'll play out maybe a couple of options. Umeh hayu omrot. What would the daughters of Jerusalem say? They would say to the men that were there, Bahur, sana inecha ure. Young man, lift up your eyes and look. Ma ata borerlach. What you have to choose from. Like what you can choose. Al titein inecha banoi. Don't look at beauty. Tein inecha bamishpacha. Look at family. This family could mean two things. It could mean sort of moral character, or it could mean lineage, literally. Just like, you know, my parents are fancy people. Probably the latter is more likely in the time of the Mishnah, but it's either one is possible here. And then we quote a verse from Mishlei, which you know from Eshechayel. Sheker hachein vehevel hayofi isha yirat Adonai hi titala. Grace is a lie. Beauty is vanity. The woman who fears God, that's who should be praised. But Omer, Tnula mi priyadeha v'yalu v'asharim maseha. And it also says in the same chapter, give her the fruit of her hands and she will be praised in the gates. Hadiz will be praised in the gates. Chen hu Omer, and so too we say, Sena urena benot zion ba'melech shlomo ba'atara she'itra lo imo b'yom chatunato u'b'yom simchat libo. Daughters of Zion, go out and see Melech Shlomo, the king Solomon, in his crown, that his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding and the day when his heart was happy. A verse from Song of Songs. And now we're going to drash out the verse. B'yom chatunato ze matan Torah. The day of his wedding, that's matan Torah, based on the long-standing tradition of interpreting Shir HaShirim as a love poem between Israel and God, as opposed to a random woman and a random man. So b'yom chatunato ze matan Torah, that's our wedding day, day of our wedding of us and God. B'yom simchat libo ze binyan beit hamikdash sheyibaneh v'mhirah v'yaminu, amen. And the day of the happiness, the rejoicing of his heart, that is the day the temple was built. Let it be built again in our days speedily, amen. So as I said, this is like a word of comfort that ends the Masechet. One of the things that it's hard to imagine about the Mishnah is when they said, Bimhira v'yameinu, they, like, speedily in our days, they really meant it. Like, they really thought that the temple could be rebuilt literally any day. in a way that we are just like 2,000 years later, it's like, it's never going to happen. that's something. And in fact, it almost happens. The temple was almost rebuilt in the 4th century by Emperor Julian. He like started the building project and then thinks something went wrong and he like lost his reign or something like that. And it fell through. But like, actually this almost happened and it was clear to them that it could happen any day. So they really meant Bim Rabbi Meinu in a way that we absolutely can't. Okay, great. So now let's talk about some more things going on in this Mishnah, which are a little bit weird and difficult. The first thing is there seems to be internal tension going on, in the sense that the whole point of them wearing white clothes is that the Emperor Julian, I'm not sure if he's called the Apostate, is the whole point of them wearing white clothes is that they shouldn't be distinguishable. Right? The whole point is that they're not embarrassing each other. They're trying to be indistinguishable from each other, which then turns in over here, Sana inecha ur'e, ma'ata v'erlach, where then the women are trying to distinguish themselves from each other. So it's like this weird internal tension of like, they're all wearing white and they all look the same, but then they're all trying to show off and attract the man's attention. So that's a little odd. Like there's a weird tension there. Another weird tension is over here, we've had the Benot Yerushalayim, which seems to be literally Benot Yerushalayim, the actual daughters of Jerusalem. Over here, we have Benot Zion, Bamelech Shlomo. And now this becomes a metaphor, Bayom Chatunato, Zematan Torah, which means the Benot Zion is not the daughters of Jerusalem anymore. It's us. It's Israel. This is Israel, and Melech Shlomo is God, in order for this metaphor to make any sense. Though the Imor then becomes a difficult part of the sentence, like who's God's mother, but that's a separate issue. So it's like, why does it start off by talking about actual daughters of Jerusalem and then suddenly veer off into making it into a metaphor about us and God? And there's also this verse from Mishle, from Eshe Chayil. It's also very odd here. They say, Al titein inecha banoi, do not look at beauty. And then they say, beauty is vanity, and yirat Hashem, the fear of God, matters. But that's not what they said. What they said was, Al titein banoi teinecha vishmacha, look at lineage. They didn't say fear of God. So it's like actually an odd mismatch that the daughters are saying, don't look at beauty because beauty doesn't matter. Look instead at lineage. And then the verse says, look at women who fear God. So that maybe that pushes you to reading Mishpacha as more like sort of the morality you grew up with, but it's still actually pretty hard and weird that it switches halfway through here. There's also another weird, just like textual issue, which is that the Benot Yerushalayim are mentioned twice, a little weirdly, right? Shemehen Benot Yerushalayim Yotzot, exactly the same sentence, Uvnot Yerushalayim Yotzot. Why does it say it twice? We're already talking about the daughters of Jerusalem. It's a little bit of an odd way to phrase it. So you can solve a lot of these questions by looking at one of the manuscripts here. So if you look at this carefully, there's a couple of important things that make this a lot easier text to read. First thing is, Lo hayu nitzavim b'Yisrael, kamichamisha asara av yom kippurim, shebehen b'nei Yerushalayim yotzin b'chlei lavan shu'ulim. So either this means specifically the sons of Israel, the sons of Jerusalem, the men, or it means everyone, right? It could mean the entire people, all the people who live in Jerusalem. Then it goes on, and then it says, Uvnot Yerushalayim yotzot v'cholot b'kramim. So that's also, so that solves that textual problem and makes this jump a little easier here. Now everyone is wearing white clothes. And then also this verse is in the manuscript, but deleted. Somebody deleted it. They didn't think it belonged in the manuscript. This is actually very hard, this text to add here. But it doesn't solve this problem over here, which is the fact that the literal dancing, the literal daughters of Zion, suddenly becomes metaphorical. So I just want to spend 1 second on that. We'll go back over here. This is one of the favorite commentaries I've ever read on a Mishnah. So the custom of wearing white in Kippur has its roots here, 100%, because you're supposed to be indistinguishable. That's actually the point of Yom Kippur, is that you're not supposed to be, you're supposed to be just you and no one else. Okay, so this is my, this is one of my favorite commentaries. So this is exactly also the connection between Yom Kippur and weddings comes up right here. So my favorite commentaries are of any mission I've ever read. This is Tiferet Yisrael, who is a 18th to 19th century commentator on the Mishnah. He is generally great, love him. He says, when he talks about this verse, he says, it seems to me that this is why this verse was brought, i.e. that certainly Yom Kippur has nothing to do with singing Young Man Lift and so on. For would you really think that Holy Israel will occupy themselves on the holy and awesome Yom Kippur with matchmaking? Literally the word he uses is shiduchim, like shidduchs. Like how can you have shidduchs on Yom Kippur? It doesn't make any sense. About this, and the Mishnah responds, and so too it says, on Yom Kippur, they incline themselves toward the Holy Blessed One, who is called Young Man, throughout the Song of Songs, such as young like cedars. Lift your eyes and see what you choose for yourself, i.e. where is a holy nation in the world like this one? He now like reads the whole text of the Mishnah as the metaphor between us and God. Do not look at beauty, for even though they sinned before you, look at family. They are your children, the children of your distinguished ones, the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We are the lineage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's why you should look at us. So what he's saying is that Yom Kippur, the whole mission is a metaphor from the start to the end, that Yom Kippur is the day where we try to dance in front of God and persuade God to choose us again for the year, which I think is like really a beautiful image. I think where we're going to end. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Shabbat shalom.